duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Welcome to the show, Higher Side Chatters. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood. I'd like to welcome back my good friend and occasional co-host, Kyle Prineville. Kyle, let him hear you.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
I am pumped that we're doing this co-host thing now. Kyle's going to be the co-host every third show of the month, and we'll release a weekly entry in his column, Conversations with the Other. I appreciate the commitment, man. I know it's not always easy to add something like this to a schedule, so thanks.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it too, man. I've been following your show since the beginning. I'm glad that in the adolescent stage, I was able to help you out early on, but I just think the quality of what the show has become is really nice, and I hope to contribute something a little more occult, a little more kind of like as what the title Conversations with the Other for the blog. I'm trying to reach something that is not typically considered part of the evidence that's thrown out. I'm going to be looking at that stuff a little bit more.
Nice. So what else is up? What's been piquing your interest lately?
I'm reading a book called Secret History of the World. I'm very excited about this book. It is trying to kind of break free some of the secrets of what in ancient Greece and in the ancient past was called the mystery schools, which existed before Christianity kind of came and erased all the information, and some would claim took it for themselves and hid it in the Vatican vaults. But it's basically about why astrology actually matters. It's not about things outside of you in the celestial bodies necessarily as much as it has to do with how these forces play on the human consciousness on the individual level. And so it's kind of taken everything from the cosmos and bringing it in and how it relates to consciousness itself. So it's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, that's funny because today the guy we're talking to, James Stein, he thinks that astrology is bullshit. So
yeah, well, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the big interest, honestly, is the Dark Knight connection to Aurora and Sandy Hook. I see the facts that both Aurora and Sandy Hook are in the Dark Knight, as are references to the old Batman comic where the guy with orange hair opens fire in the theater and James Holmes dyed his hair red in the Aurora shootings. It's all very strange, and the symbolism here seems too overt. Like, it's almost like they overstepped. But man, the question for me with these types of subtle reveals is why? You know, I just don't understand why. Like, especially in the internet age, because it just, you know, it highlights the fact that it was a false flag attack. If we didn't have all the symbolism within the Dark Knight, I mean, it would have been a little tougher to piece together.
Yeah, and Hollywood is known for having a history of hiding subliminal symbolism within the movies and things. You know, even kids' movies, Rugrats and stuff you would never expect, but there is some methodology to putting it in plain sight and playing on your subconscious mind where you consciously think nothing about it. You don't even notice, and then maybe it's embedding something in there. Maybe it's tugging on something inside you.
Yeah, there's that. There's also the idea that our subconscious, our collective unconscious mind is timeless. And so when a huge event happens that everyone knows about, it sends reverberations through that subconscious, you know, in a timeless way. So that's, you'll see things come out in media. You know, there'll be the idea, the guy who's drawing the Rugrats will have the idea of putting a plane behind the Twin Towers, because it's something that's just in the back of his mind that he doesn't even realize. Kind of like being inspired by the muse in a way that is kind of negative. But I don't know. To me, some of it seems so weird, and so, like, the foresight is just immense. Like, there's some stuff in X-Files episodes. Like, that's 10 years previous. Like, sure, it could be, but also it could be something else, too. It could be some kind of weird mechanism with the subconscious that we don't understand, too.
Yeah, I totally believe a lot of it could be unexpected and unexplainable.
And then there's also the LIBOR connection to the two shootings, which is pretty nuts. I'm sure you heard about that. And the weird memorial page, the fucking memorial page for the girl, one of the girls who died in Sandy Hook went up the day before And then it was like, it's really interesting because you could see somebody posted from an anonymous, you know, username, bury it or something right along the lines of like, bury this page. And then all of a sudden it was flooded with all kinds of porn. And, you know, when a page like that gets flooded with porn, it gets taken down. And it's weird that that was the method they used to get it taken down. But yeah, you can see little snippets of like an authoritative figure directing people to be like, all right, destroy it. And it's kind of weird. But yeah, it goes up the day before. They're getting sloppy, man. They're really getting fucking sloppy.
I think it's a combination of them getting sloppy because they must be rushed or something. And in conjunction with there is some level of people who are having an awakening. And I think with Facebook and social media, like connecting everybody who is a truther, I think when they try to pull off a psyop, like the Colorado shooter especially, or the Sandy Hook, which is just totally mysterious, I think that more people are awake, more people know which questions to ask. I think people on the internet do an incredible amount of journalism that you would never see on mainstream media. And they're pulling at threads, and they uncover a lot of things, a lot of weird, like the Sandy Hook actors is what really just creeps me out. You know, see these guys laughing, and then 2 seconds later, he's like, oh, my daughter died, blah, blah, blah. Her favorite thing was painting, and he can't even cry. And 1 second earlier, he was laughing and be like, okay, are we ready? And then he takes a couple deep breaths. He's in character, and he's like, okay, here we go.
Right. Yeah, that was... I guess some people have a hard time. I've shown that to a lot of people, and some really have a tough time seeing that as evidence. But to me, it's pretty fucking clear. I'm like, you got to remember, like, this guy's daughter died that day, or maybe it was the day previous. I think it was that day is the official story. And his daughter would be in elementary school. Like, that's got to be fucking shocking. How are you laughing about anything, you know? And that's fucked up. The coroner is kind of fucked up. The guy's doing the autopsies, and they're questioning about what bullets were used, and he's just naming bullets and like, but that gun was in the car. And he's like, look, you know, he says something like, if you have good photographers, you can make the story whatever you want it to be. And I have great photographers.
Yeah, that's the most cryptic thing he says, but he literally has no answers for any of the questions, nor does it in any way remotely seem like he actually went in there and saw anything. You know, they ask him, did you see the shooter? Oh no, I'll get to that tomorrow. Like, did you see the bodies? How many boys? How many girls? Nah, you know, I don't know. And he's just laughing, cracking jokes. You know, I can understand a lot of people say he's under an incredible amount of stress. This guy's never seen anything like this in his life. Of course, he's like shell-shocked. This coroner is not the kind of guy who talks to the media typically anyways. All that being said, what he actually says is very weird and cryptic, and the whole thing, you know, it's all Mr. X. It's all meant to, you know, you can't really pin down what happened, but it is very strange the way it all played out.
That seems to be another aspect to it is, you know, someone who doesn't like these type of conspiracies will look to me and be like, okay, well then what happened, dude? Then what happened? I'm like, look, I can't tell you what happened, but I can tell you that it looks pretty good that what the media is telling you happened, it didn't. And that should be, that's the story. Like, you don't really need to know exactly what happened to believe that you're being lied to. And I hate that false premise, because it's like, oh, just because I can't explain it, being some fucking stupid stoner in California who's just looking stuff up on the internet, you can see that things don't make sense, but that doesn't mean I can tell you that it was, you know, an Israeli black ops project, which is one of the ideas.
Right, and the classic difficulty with 9/11 is you get into such strange things when you're actually trying to formulate, you know, the one unifying theory, how it did actually play out. You just become victim to intentional misdirects. I think it's disinfo agents put out things like, oh, it was mini nukes, or it was a particle weapon from the sky, or it was a hologram and things never actually hit, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, any one of these you would actually support, you're going to discredit yourself. So they do this kind of stuff so that anybody who does try to track down the truth always, you know, everybody, just as you said, it's like puts the burden of proof on them rather than putting it on the media.
It's a fucked up world. And I actually think we're going to see shootings happen until the public really lets them take guns away in a big way.
Mm.
I mean, that's just an opinion, but I feel like if you see that happening, that kind of validates the theory that people are saying, which is this is to get guns taken away. Or, I mean, a lot of people think it's even simpler and that it's just to keep the heat off of the financial sector. If we're paying attention to something bigger and scarier and more in your face, you don't have time to look at the LIBOR scandal. You don't have time to look at the financial corruption.
Yeah, or the fact that HSBC laundered billions of dollars of drug money from Mexican cartels and were found guilty and no one was prosecuted.
Yeah.
But we really got to talk about gun laws. You know, that's a primary, you know, urgent concern here.
Of course. Oh, man, they say in the Age of Enlightenment, the lies seem more transparent. And I think it's kind of convenient that the lies do seem more transparent.
Yeah, one of the more strange things I read recently, too, is scientists have made a couple different claims, such as that DNA might actually be four-stranded.
Yeah.
They've documented that there's at least one child who has three-strand DNA.
Man.
And so this whole idea of, like, genetic manipulation, I mean, like, transformation,
yes,
or ascension or whatever, you know, there's a lot of these strange words for it,
yeah,
that are essentially, you know, it could mean all sorts of things, but maybe there's some scientific evidence that some strange stuff's going on with the DNA.
I saw that and I was like, man, there are thousands of New Agers hard as a rock right now with this information, because that's what they've been talking about. They've been talking about a real biological transformation and evolution, and it seems silly because you're like, this is something we should just clearly be able to see or not see. And then all of a sudden, boom, story comes up and it's like, there it is. But anyway, all that stuff is fucking fascinating. But today, it's about time we patch in this new guest today. We got James Stein. He is the author of The Paranormal Equation. Pretty interesting book. I know you didn't get a chance to read it, but, you know, he's basically a really established mathematician who takes a look at the paranormal and tries to determine if there is unseen forces that we just can't detect yet, or if maybe the whole sector of paranormal activity is just off limits using scientific methods. And that's an interesting conclusion to come to for someone who spent a lot of their time developing their scientific prowess to be like, well, maybe it's just out of the realm of what we can discover.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, let's get them in here.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
Well, Higher Side Chatters, it's a real honor to have Jim Stein on the show today. He graduated from Yale University with a major in mathematics and a minor in physics, then went on to receive a doctorate in mathematics from the University of California, Berkeley. He's written several books, including How Math Explains the World, How Math Can Save Your Life, and his most recent book, The Reason He Landed on THC, The Paranormal Equation, A New Scientific Perspective on Remote Viewing, Clairvoyance, and Other Unexplicable Phenomena. Jim, say hello to the people.
Hello, and I'll also say hello to you, Greg. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Of course, man. We also have Kyle here, a longtime friend and occasional co-host. Kyle, say hello to the people.
Also, we'll say hello to Kyle.
Hello to you as well, James, and to the people.
Well, welcome to the show. I'm psyched to have you here. Usually people like me have to pay good money to speak to someone with your credentials, so I appreciate that.
Well, actually, that's not the case. We don't generally charge consulting fees like doctors or lawyers. You can walk into any university, find a professor, and talk to him for absolutely nothing.
True, but it's just about getting on that campus. College itself is pretty expensive.
College itself is pretty expensive, but a lot of teachers just leave their door open because they figure if somebody comes in and wants to ask them a question, their function in life is to answer questions. Now, admittedly, most of the people who walk in my door are my students.
Right. Makes sense. Well, Jim, you wrote a fascinating book. It's really awesome, The Paranormal Equation. I had a lot of fun with it. But I got to ask you about something that was in your bio. You know, sometimes the publishers will include a little about the author sheet when they send out media copies. And usually they're pretty predictable, but out of nowhere, yours says that in college you and your roommates owned a lion?
Honest to God.
That's pretty intense.
Yes, it's very true. And I don't know how deeply you want to go into this. But
yeah,
what happened was I had a bunch of very interesting roommates. One ended up on the front page of the LA Times about 20 years ago because he was the president of the firm that froze Ted Williams. You know who Ted Williams was?
Yeah. Baseball, right?
Baseball player.
Yeah.
Baseball player. Teddy Ballgame. Anyway, one of my roommates was the head of the firm that did that. But anyway, we had a house in a suburb of Oakland, and all of a sudden they come up to me one day and they say, "Jim, how would you feel about having a lion?" Well, I'd had a lot of ridiculous ideas, so I just and usually nothing generally came to pass because one of my roommates had very low metabolism and slept a lot. So I figured this was just another abstract question. And then a few weeks later, there was this 20-pound lion on our carpet because it turns out lions breed very well in captivity, and they got a baby lion from the Los Angeles Zoo.
We had the lion for
about a year. Then we moved to Berkeley. By this time, my roommates were very big guys, and they were in the habit of roughhousing with the lion, which was okay when the lion was fairly small. But when the lion reached about 150, 200 pounds, it was a lot more than they could handle. So
yeah.
They boarded the lion on at an animal ranch or something like that on the Russian River in Northern California, and they would go visit it. But the lion's claws got very large, and they still wanted to roughhouse with the lion, so they decided to have the lion declawed, and unfortunately, the lion went into anaphylactic shock during the operation and died.
Oh, my God. I was not expecting that M. Night
Shyamalan
twist right there. Yeah. I mean, that's scary.
But it was an interesting experience, and if you doubt it, there's at least two proofs of this that I know of. A picture of the lion was on the front page of the Oakland Tribune, I think one day in 1966, and also one of the three major networks at the time came and visited us because the city of Oakland wanted to kick us out, and the ACLU defended us, and so one of the three networks came around to do a news show on it, and the news show got broadcast because I guess they were really short of news, so it's there somewhere. It's there somewhere in cyberspace.
Wow. What an awesome little piece of life. You know, I wish I had a lion.
It was entertaining. It was entertaining. I could tell you a lot more stories, but this is not the time nor the place.
Right. I mean, your accomplishments in mathematics are obviously great, and with spending so much time in the traditional left brain thinking patterns, I mean, it is interesting. How did you keep from just writing off all paranormal activity as nonsense, like so many others in your field?
That's an extremely good question, and it came about through a bunch of different circumstances. The first was that I like to read about history of science, and I also have a lot of friends, artists, people like that, who are interested in the paranormal. But what was really surprising to me is that I have friends who are just as left-brained as I am, who have beliefs that, to my normal way of thinking, stretch credibility a little. For instance, the brightest mathematician I know believes in reincarnation, and not only that, he thinks he can demonstrate it scientifically and logically. And I have a very good friend who's a doctor who's had the same experience a number of times. I think you would call it something like clairvoyance or deja vu or something like that. He's told me he's walked into rooms and known exactly what was going to be in the room even before he walked into it. And these are people that I've known for a long period of time. They're very bright. They're established in their fields. And they have had these experiences which lead them to believe that there are things which are beyond the power of science, at least science as we currently know it, to explain. And they're not the only ones. There have been some truly brilliant scientists who have believed in the paranormal and the supernatural. Probably the leading individual at the moment who fits into that category is a guy named Brian Josephson, who won a Nobel Prize in physics. And he's written papers on the connection between telepathy and quantum mechanics and things like that. And my feeling is that no matter what you feel, if somebody is demonstrably bright, as a Brian Josephson says that he thinks that there's merit in this, you got to take it more seriously than if just some individual with no technical training does. So that was one of the things that got me interested in it. And another thing was that it strikes me that even if you don't believe at all in it, it's still a very interesting subject for possible speculation. I remember when I was about 11 or 12 years old, the New York Herald Tribune ran a series of articles on an individual named Bridie Murphy. Now, this is probably earlier than most of the most of your listeners are familiar with, but there was a psychologist in Colorado who subjected one of his patients to hypnosis and past life regression. And during the hypnotic sessions, this individual started speaking in an Irish accent and described her life as Bridie Murphy, a woman who lived in 18th century Ireland.
Wow.
They serialized this in the new... Yeah, I mean, this is something that, you know, that just makes you blink. And this was obviously fascinating, not only to me, because I was 11 or 12 years old at the time, something in that range, but it was obviously fascinating to a lot of people because it was a continuing story in the newspaper for a number of days, possibly even weeks. I just don't recall. But what happened was that somebody did some digging around, and they found that the woman who'd been the subject of the past life regression had a long-forgotten neighbor named Bridie Murphy Corkle, who had possibly told her some stories, and maybe the hypnotic patient had also read something about that era. And so even though this wasn't something that was fraudulent in any way, shape, or form, there was at least a possible rational explanation for it. So I sort of had that on the back burner. And then what happened is my doctor friend, who's had the deja vu experiences, and I were once discussing things, and he said, you know, Jim, there are three types of facts in the universe. There are the known facts, the unknown facts, and the unknowable facts. And I sort of puzzled over this one because, I mean, things like there are lots of known facts floating around, like hydrogen is the lightest atom. It's that's a known fact. We've measured all the atoms. That's it. There are also unknown facts, such as whether or not there has ever been life on Mars. We don't know at the moment. It's a matter of conjecture, but I'm hoping we get to Mars and find out, preferably within my lifetime, because if not, it's not going to do me any good.
Right.
But unless somebody decides to clone me later on, but that's another story. But even so, it's an unknown fact, because either there has been life on Mars or there has not been life on Mars, and it's decided if we could get to Mars, we'd find out. But even if we don't find out, it's still a fact one way or the other. So that comes under the heading of unknown fact at the moment. But the question might be, what's an unknowable fact? And this one had me puzzled for a while until a few years ago when I started to write another book. Since you mentioned the title, I don't feel any shame in giving it a plug. namely how math explains the world. In the 1930s, a mathematician by the name of Kurt Gödel discovered something that absolutely blew mathematics away at the time. He discovered that there were unknowable facts in mathematics. And one thing that I've discovered about mathematics is that people generally love it if you talk about it. For instance, that would make the television show Numbers so popular. But they're not so wild about it if you actually get down and dirty and do mathematics. And so I promise your listeners that I won't do mathematics, but I do have to discuss a couple of things in conjunction with this, if it's okay with you.
Of course.
Okay. At some stage, most of your listeners will have taken a course in geometry, or they'll have seen something called the Pythagorean theorem, which was discovered 2,500 years ago. It isn't even necessary that you remember what the Pythagorean theorem was, except that it said something about right triangles. Now, there are an infinite number of right triangles, and in order to establish the truth of what the Pythagorean theorem says about right triangles, you obviously can't go around and measure every right triangle. There are an infinite number of them, and you just don't have time. So what you have to do is you have to prove the Pythagorean theorem logically from the hypotheses or the axioms of geometry. So that's one way you can deal with an infinite collection of possible truths, by proving them logically. The other way is that you can actually discard a possible infinite collection of possible truths by showing that there's one which isn't. For instance, suppose I were to say to you, Greg, the sum of two odd numbers is odd. You'd think for a while on this, probably not a very long while, and you'd say, Jim, 3 is odd, 5 is odd, 3 plus 5 is 8, that's not odd, so that's false. So you can either prove that that a collection of infinite collection of statements is true via proof, or you can establish that it's false by finding a single example which demonstrates that it's false. And up until the 1930s, mathematicians thought that this was all you could do when faced with a statement about an infinite number of possibilities. You could either prove that it was true, or you could find a particular example to demonstrate that it was false. And what Gödel did, which was absolutely incredible at the time, and is still, in my opinion, the most exciting mathematical discovery of the 20th century, he proved that there were true facts that could not be proven via mathematics. And that's, you know, that's the type of thing which is almost philosophical in nature. And as a matter of fact, it has prompted a whole lot of debate on what the nature of truth is, as well as what the nature of mathematical proof is. But the when I was writing the book, in which I included this result of Gödel, it's known as the Gödel incompleteness theorem, I realized that I hadn't seen anywhere where people had taken the results of this and looked at the possible ramifications of it in an infinite universe. Because in an infinite universe, there's the possibility that there are true relationships between the physical parameters of the universe. And by that I mean things like mass, length, time, force, energy, information, the stuff out of which the universe is built. And the stuff that we see, for instance, you know, probably the most famous equation in math and physics is E equals mc squared, you know, Einstein's famous equation. And even if you don't know exactly what it means, you know it's a great truth. And Einstein established it logically, but we've done a bunch of experiments which have confirmed that this is true, at least within our ability to confirm them. Physics and science are one step short of mathematical proof, because you can deduce whatever you want, but the universe decides whether or not it's true. And you do a lot of experiments, and eventually you never really prove that it's true. What you do is you show it's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly unlikely that it's false. And that's where we stand with Einstein's E equals mc squared. It's incredibly, 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 incredibly unlikely that it's false. And that's the best we can ever do. But it may very well be, if Gödel's result about mathematics can be applied to an infinite universe, that there's some relationship between the physical parameters of the universe, like an equation, you know, maybe an equation like E equals mc squared, which control the physical parameters of the universe, but which we'll never be able to establish that it's true, and we may never even get a hint of what it is. And if you're willing to, you know, if you're willing to stretch this a little, it's possible that this could be an explanation for some of the phenomena that we've yet to be able to pin down in our universe. Now, if you were to ask me about it, I think it's a long shot. But it's a very possible long shot, and stranger things have happened. I don't know, are you familiar with a phenomenon called entanglement?
Yes, that was actually one of my questions. There seems to be a lot of things at the quantum level that New Agers point to validate, you know, their theories or their ideas about consciousness and reality. And it really throws me for a loop when you get down to the quantum level. It seems like there's teleportation of atoms, there's atoms need a conscious observer, and then the entanglement issue. There's a lot going on there.
There's a whole lot. And one of the things that I worry about is I worry about when you visit a website or you read a book and a New Ager says quantum mechanics supports this, and then makes a statement about consciousness or belief or paranormal phenomena. As far as we know at the moment, quantum mechanics says nothing about this stuff. Now, I'm not saying that if you see on a website that that quantum mechanics supports whatever it is that somebody's trying to pitch, I'm not saying that it's outright fraud, because a lot of people do, you know, they read something, they accept it secondhand or third hand, they don't bother to dig into it, and that's not really fraud, it's just sort of on the nature of, you know, of sloppy behavior, which everybody goes through, you know, which everybody is a victim of at some time or another.
Yeah, tell me about it.
I'm no exception. But, quantum mechanics is essentially a computational procedure for dealing with subatomic particles and particles at the atomic level. That's all that we've been able to do at the moment that we've been able to do anything in the way of confirmation of. I'll discuss entanglement in a moment, but here's my feeling about it. If you were to look at the various sciences, if you were to look at certainly mathematics, if you're willing to consider it a science, is the most evolved of the sciences because we've been doing it for 2,500 years and it doesn't require complicated lab experiments to substantiate. You do it logically, and even though in the European world we sort of took a pause in doing it during the Middle Ages from about 500 to 1500 AD, nonetheless it's been an ongoing procedure. If you look at physics started with Isaac Newton. That's about 1650. And that's the most highly developed of our formal subjects. Excuse me. Chemistry started with Lavoisier and John Dalton in the 18th century. That's the next most developed. Biology and anything related to life is a much more recent phenomenon. Up until the early portion of the 19th century, they believed in a theory called vitalism, in which somehow processes involving life were mechanically and physically different from processes that did not involve life. There was something called a vital spark, which gave, which animated living things. And it wasn't until the early portion of the 19th century that we started discovering that there was such a thing as biochemistry. The processes of life are really at a deeper level, physical and chemical processes. And the mathematics that underpins the study of physics or chemistry is much more highly developed than the mathematics that underpins the study of living things. If you were to ask me, and I'm not an expert on this, but my guess is that the interactions of what goes on in a single cell is a much more complex and much less well understood phenomenon than the gravitational and electromagnetic interactions in a galaxy filled with stars. And as a result, in order to say that quantum mechanics supports our ideas on consciousness or New Age philosophy, I'm not going to say it's complete nonsense, because it's possible that something like that may come to pass. But at the moment, to say something like that is just taking a giant leap where no man has gone yet and shouldn't be going at this moment, because we're not yet ready for it. But there are some things that quantum mechanics has looked at over the last century, which is about how long quantum mechanics has been in existence, that completely puzzle them. And they are known phenomena at the subatomic level, and they don't understand it. And one of the things is called entanglement. And when we look at the universe that we know, it's impossible for information to be transmitted from one place to another at anything faster than the speed of light. That's just what we know about the universe. But nonetheless, there's something called entanglement as a way that two different particles can relate to each other. Entangled particles, we have not yet produced entangled cells or entangled fish or entangled people, but we've produced things like entangled photons and entangled electrons and entangled calcium atoms. And what we have discovered, and also by experiment, is that if you have entangled particles that are separated, and a measurement is made on one of them, the other particle knows exactly what the result of that measurement was. And we've confirmed in the laboratory that this knowledge, as it were, takes place faster than at the speed of light. I think they've done it at something like a distance of 40 miles or something like that. But there's nothing in what we know about physics that says that if you've got two entangled particle universes that are separated by billions of light years, a measurement made on one of them will be instantaneously known to the other one. And at the moment, there have been a lot of ingenious methods that have been proposed for explaining why this should be true. They've all been shot down in one way or another. At the moment, we cannot explain entanglement. We know that it's a real phenomena. Now, in that sense, it sort of differs from paranormal phenomena such as clairvoyance or remote viewing or telepathy, which we're not really sure whether or not they are real phenomena. My feeling about that is that it's pretty much, it's sort of like how we feel about UFOs. When you look at UFO sightings, the vast majority of them can be discarded, but there are a few of them which nobody's yet been able to explain. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't an explanation lurking around there somewhere, but it's also possible, when I say an explanation, you know, weather balloons, fog, what have you, something that explains the other ones. But at the moment, we can't cite those as actually being legitimate explanations for the UFO phenomena that we can't explain, and therefore you have to allow for the possibility that little green men are visiting our planet. I think that that's a very remote possibility, but it's still on the table. It hasn't been ruled out. And as far as entanglement, I'm sorry.
I'm very interested in the connection between entanglement and remote viewing specifically, because it seems to me that if you accept like a Neoplatonist view where there's an information field that connects everything underlying matter, then perhaps when someone is engaging in remote viewing and has a personal subjective experience where they in a way contact information and become entangled with information and they haven't traveled any distance, I think that there's some similarities there. Maybe some overlap, not necessarily that the consciousness is one particle, the entangling with one piece of information as a particle, but similarities in a lot of ways.
That's, I think, a very reasonable possibility. In fact, it's one of the possibilities for this that I would certainly accept. I don't think we're at the point yet where we can say, yes, this is the way it is. One of the reasons that I'd like to live for longer than I'm going to live is that I feel that, given the fact that the pace of our learning stuff accelerates, I think that something like that may well be discovered in maybe within the next 20 years, maybe within the next 50 or 100, maybe even 1,000 years. But I think we'll know something along that line. On the other hand, I think there is the possibility, and I don't know. Again, it's a function of the hypothesis that the universe is infinite. If the universe is infinite and Gödel's results do apply to the physical parameters of the universe, there may be a governing principle which is an unknowable fact. And even though we might suspect it, we'll never be able to establish it the way that we could establish E equals mc squared. If you were to ask me, I think that your explanation and mine are two of the leading contenders at the moment, and I don't know which I would say is the favorite. And,
look at that.
But before that, you actually have to establish. You see, one of the difficulties in this area, and it's a great difficulty, is that if you look at things like remote viewing, or you look at things like clairvoyance or telepathy, it's very difficult to say, yes, here we have a cut-and-dried example of it that we can reproduce in the laboratory. Because what science is about is objective phenomena. And if you take a look at, you know, what's the difference between objective and subjective phenomena? Well, if you stick a thermometer in my living room at the moment where I'm talking to you, you'd probably see that it reads 72 degrees, and anybody else who looks at it would say, yeah, it reads 72 degrees. Conclusion, it's 72 degrees in the room. That's objective. But when you're talking about phenomena that are as subtle as remote viewing or telepathy, it's very hard to get your hands on what would be definitive experiments to confirm it. And as a result, science tends to, and I talk from the standpoint of a scientist, I don't think science should be in the business of dismissing possible explanations. And for instance, Einstein said something that I think is very reasonable with regard to telepathy. He was asked by a psychologist friend of his what he thought about telepathy and what the physics that Einstein knew had to say about it. And Einstein said, "It seems to me at any rate that we have no right from a physical standpoint to deny a priori the possibility of telepathy. For that sort of denial, the foundations of our science are too unsure and too incomplete." And he said that 80 years ago, and he's been, you know, he died in 1955. But my guess is that if he were alive today, and I don't want to put words in Einstein's mouth, but so this is just a conjecture on my part, but if he were alive today, he'd look at where physics is and he'd say, "You've made a lot of progress. I'm really impressed. But I still stand by what I said, you know, what I said when I first discussed the possibility of telepathy. I don't think you can rule it out." And what you have in physics at the moment is you have two schools. You have the Brian Josephson school, who believes that it's a real phenomenon and is investigating it and trying to explain it. And you also have some of Josephson's colleagues at the same universities, or at least Josephson is either at Oxford or Cambridge, I can't remember which, and one of his colleagues at either Oxford or Cambridge came right out when Josephson made a statement about the relationship, about telepathy and physical exploration of it, said, rubbish, telepathy does not exist. So you have two decidedly different views on it by two decidedly bright people. And I think that, you know, the person who said telepathy doesn't exist, I think that's the wrong thing for science to say. I think what he could certainly say is that as of this moment, we have no evidence for it. We can't devise experiments which either prove it or disprove it. But as Einstein said, the foundations of our science are too unsure and too incomplete. And even at the moment, I feel it's extremely unlikely that it's a phenomenon. You can't rule it out. Because one of the things that continually happens in science is that what you think now may be overturned shortly. I tell people that science isn't the last word. It's just the latest word.
Yeah, I like that. You have that in the book, too. I think that's a good way to approach it because so many people, they spend so much time in the universities and they kind of come out with, you know, almost a stagnant education to that, you know, this is as far as we got. If it hasn't been discovered by now, it doesn't exist. And that's not really the best attitude.
Oh, I agree with you. But I think they're not just saying if it hasn't been discovered by now, it doesn't exist. I think what they're saying is that there has been some work on it, and there has been, certainly there's been work on ESP. And I've had communications recently with somebody who's done a bunch of work in this area and believes that it's a real phenomenon and is encountering the difficulty that the scientific establishment simply won't look at what he considers to be evidence. And this is a story about science that has been basically ongoing. And because science is a human, you know, science is a human pursuit. And that means that you have the results of science are essentially what human beings discover. I mean, admittedly, you could have a discussion here about what is abstract truth and what have we discovered that we think is truth. But I'm not a philosopher, and I'm not going there. But what you have is something very important that governs science, and that's called money.
Yeah, it governs everything.
Yeah. As a result, if you take a look, you know, scientific investigations are generally underwritten by one of two types of agencies. They're underwritten by governments, which give money to colleges, and they're underwritten by corporations or companies. And in both instances, the people who give money to science are looking at science to produce something. They're willing to settle for some sort of abstract knowledge in some area, but they'd like something with potential bottom-line payoff, especially a corporation, because a corporation, you know, has to deliver to its stockholders, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm a big fan of capitalism. And certainly one of the things that I like about science is science has demonstrably made my life more comfortable. And while that's not the goal of science, it's certainly a side effect, and it's an extremely beneficial one. And boy, do I applaud that. But if you just say that you're a corporation, who are you going to give money to? Are you going to give money to somebody who's investigating the possibility of finding a cure for cancer, which you can translate into lots of money and a better standard of life for people? Or are you going to give it to somebody who's investigating telepathy, which so far, most of the people you ask would say this hasn't really gotten anywhere. And even if you demonstrate it, well, it's remotely possible at some stage that we might be so telepathically competent that it will replace the internet, but not in the near future. So the payoff, what you have is, you know, if I were awarding money or if I were investing money, what I'd look at is I'd look at a combination of the possibility that you'll get something good out of it plus the value of what you get out of it. And on that scale, investigations into the paranormal and the supernatural rank pretty low.
Well, let me ask you kind of another question in regards to the paranormal. What are your thoughts on the idea of a collective unconscious or a higher self or a hive mind? Is there any scientific basis for any of that?
Okay, this isn't my area of expertise.
Sure.
So, because what you're talking about now is you're talking about psychology and you're talking about biology, but this is just something. This is just something in the way of personal belief, and maybe it's a hangover from the 1960s and the 1970s, which is when I was a graduate student, just starting out on my career. But I believe, for instance, life is more than the sum of the species that make it up. I believe that the universe is greater than the stuff that actually makes it up. And I think that things like this are possible. I certainly don't rule, you know, my belief is that there is something more than, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And I think that I can't substantiate that scientifically, but there is a branch of mathematics called complexity theory. And in complexity theory, what you discover is that even the most apparently simple systems have unbelievably complex outcomes associated with them. And that's an overstatement and much more qualitative than the subject actually is. But it is surprising how often simple systems give rise to complex behavior. And this happens in physics, it happens in chemistry, it certainly happens in biology. And so I'm not ruling that out. And if you were to ask me, I think it's certainly possible, maybe not at our level of evolution, but Homo sapiens isn't going to be around forever. Evolution dictates that something else is going to replace us. And that something else is going to be better suited to deal, because that's what natural selection is. And possibly what replaces us next has capabilities that our species does not, that may very well fall into the area of the paranormal. You can't say if you were to look at, if you were to look at what we do as Homo sapiens, using the capabilities that we have, they greatly transcend what Neanderthal man had, and Neanderthal man greatly transcends what chimpanzees could do, and so on down the evolutionary scale.
One thing I want to say is you take issue in the book with numerology and astrology, and of course I would expect you to, but when I think about numerology, I think about it sort of in the way Native American cultures attributed certain traits to different animals based on how they were perceived and their general personality of the species. I could kind of see numbers representing certain traits based on how they act in mathematics and geometry, and a more advanced application of that being an understanding that certain numbers inherently allow you to have a language and with which to communicate with the universe. I mean, that's a lot of new agey kind of stuff, but you give an interesting example in the book about the number 8 and that it was always looked at as a positive, lucky number. And now science now knows that the atomic number of oxygen is 8. It's also the sign for infinity, but to me that is numerology. Could it be coincidence, or if you want to get weird with the collective unconscious, then it could reveal something about the nature of time and the mind, and that our knowledge of the periodic table and elements now could have affected our feelings about the number 8 in the subconscious thousands of years earlier. It's a far stretch, but what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, I'm with you. I think that's an impossible stretch. And although the explanation that you give is possibly a better explanation for the possible validity of something like that than anything I've heard from some other people. The reason that I doubt stuff such as numerology and astrology, and when I say I doubt them as explanations for phenomena, because they've done. I don't know how much has been done with respect to numerology, but I certainly know it's been done with respect to astrology. And astrology, when it's been examined for the predictions that it makes, for instance, such and such things are leadership signs, maybe Aries is a sign of leadership. They've done analyses like this, and they've come out no better than chance. They've taken a whole bunch of leaders or a whole bunch of Aries, and they've done statistical analyses, comes out no bigger than chance. But I look at it, where is this stuff coming from? And admittedly, that's an ad hominem argument, and the explanation you propose, something like a collective unconsciousness twigged into this, that's not an ad hominem argument. And by the ad hominem argument that I'm going to use, you look at people who say, this is the wisdom of the ancients. Well, I think the ancients had a lot of wisdom. I think they were very wise when it came to interpersonal relationships, how people fit in with other people and how people fit into societies. You read some of the stuff in the religious and philosophical tracts that were written thousands of years ago. You read something like Oedipus Rex or the great plays of the Greek playwrights, And these people really understood, really had wisdom with regard to how people react with each other. On the other hand, if you look at what they actually knew about the physical universe, damn little. They had nothing resembling, you know, they could build stuff. They could do a whole bunch of ad hoc things without, you know, they could build pyramids. They, you know, the Egyptians built the pyramids. The Greeks built the Parthenon. The people on Easter Island built those huge heads. So you could do a lot of building on the basis of trial and error learning of stuff. But in terms of having some sort of great basis of understanding the way the universe works, my feeling is it doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell, because these were people who thought that when they saw lightning in the sky, the gods were throwing thunderbolts at each other. They thought that disease was the result of the anger of the gods. Things like this. They had no explanation. You know, they had stuff that we explain on a routine basis. They were totally and completely off base on. So, to think that they could simultaneously think that the gods are throwing thunderbolts at each other, and simultaneously come up with an explanation of the fact that eight is lucky, and eight is lucky for Oriental cultures. I'm not sure it's lucky for every culture. And if you take a look at a whole lot of the beliefs of astrology, for instance, astrology was devised by Ptolemy, who lived a few centuries after Christ. And Ptolemy was an incredibly brilliant guy for his time, and he knew a lot. And he had some very reasonable theories. For instance, Ptolemy devised a theory of planetary motion, which was superseded by Kepler and Newton, but only when they had much better observations. Ptolemy had to just look at the sky and see what was happening, and he came up with a brilliant possible explanation for it, which was wrong, but nonetheless was an intelligent explanation based on what he knew. And Linus Pauling, who was a very brilliant scientist from the 20th century, who won a Nobel Prize for chemistry and also a Nobel Peace Prize, was once giving a lecture on a college campus. I saw this on a Nova TV show. And Linus Pauling was always one of my heroes for a number of reasons. We were on the same side of the political fence, number one. Number two is I have a lot of respect for anybody who wins a Nobel Prize. And number three was he had an endearing quality that I've never seen in virtually anyone and that I wish I had. When he was asked a question, he would pause for 5 seconds while collecting his thoughts and then articulate the answer in complete sentences. You'd never hear him say, you know, et cetera, while he's spinning it, while his brain is spinning around trying to find an answer. Just uncommon. Wish I had that. But anyway, he was asked during this, during the video that I saw, he was asked by a college student what he thought of astrology. And he thought about it for the 5 seconds, and he said exactly what I said. He said that Ptolemy was the person responsible for it. Ptolemy was a very brilliant scientist from about the 2nd or 3rd century after Christ. And he said that if Ptolemy were alive today, Pauling, was virtually certain that Ptolemy was a good enough scientist to look at what had happened and said, you know, so much more is known today that I totally reject astrology as a possible explanation for the way things are. And I'm in total agreement with that. And one of the things that I've always... one of the things that always amuses me, and I do mention this in the book, is that, for instance, if you are into numerology, a core concept of numerology is something called life path number. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I think Kyle is probably even a little more familiar, but yeah.
I mean, what you do is you express your birthday in terms of month, day, and year. For instance, in case somebody wants to send me a birthday present, I was born on August 29th, 1941. That's 8/29, 1941. So you add 8/29/1941, you get the number 34. You then add 3 and 4, that gives you 7. That's your life path number. And so these life path numbers are supposed to be indicative of, a certain, people who have life path numbers of 7 exhibit one set of traits. People who have life path numbers of 2 exhibit another set of traits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there are a couple of things that there are several things that I find really confusing about this. Numerology was presumably devised about 2,500 years ago. At that time, the decimal system wasn't even in existence. So how can this possibly be right? That's number one. Number two, and what I think is even more interesting, is that in about the year 1572, although I could be wrong, they noticed that what was happening is because they had not computed the length of the year properly, that the seasons were slipping from where they thought they were. What I mean by that is, winter's always in, October, November, December, January, that period. Summer's in the other, at least if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and, this was taking place in the Northern Hemisphere. And they noticed that things were getting out of sync. And so what they did is they recalculated what the length of the year was supposed to be. And in order to get things right, what they did was they skipped a period. What they did was, I think the day after October 4th, 1572, was mandated to be October 15th, 1572. In other words, they cut 10 days out. Now, what that does is it totally screws up life path calculations.
I can see that. I mean, I know Kyle's looked into numerology and astrology a little more than I have, and we've been friends for 20 years. He was always the more left brain. He almost was close to a minor in mathematics, but you've gone the other way, man. What do you think about numerology and astrology?
Well, I just wanted to an interesting point is that when we talk about astrology and numerology, we are looking at it within the context of our scientific era. So we look at it in a very mechanistic way. We think your life number is supposed to determine something about the way the mechanism is supposed to flow in your life. But in the past, I would believe that the ancients actually had a much different context, much different understanding about the nature of the universe and how the mechanisms worked. And I think if you reread like Homer's classics, like the Iliad, when he says something like, the gods intervened and did something, they say it in almost a matter-of-fact way that they thought that this was literally true, that this wasn't the allegory that it's taken to be today where we dismiss it because it doesn't make sense to our current understanding. I think conversely, if you had Socrates here joining our conversation, he may not agree with their current-day understanding of the mechanistic universe, even though we say that science has evolved so much and we've learned so much more. I would say that it really is based in the context of our understanding. And that's why numerology seems so strange nowadays, where it may not have in the past.
I think that's sort of a reasonable way of looking at it, because culture determines a lot about the way you think. I mean, there's no question that if you were to look at the way different cultures view certain things that we would call the universe. I know that the Eastern culture looks at the universe and the process of living in the universe in a very different way than Western cultures look at it, and in a lot of instances, these are adaptive to making your life better, and they help you. If something helps you, what was that song? Whatever gets you through the night. If you have a way of regarding things, and it makes life better and more comfortable for you, that has value in itself, and that value to some extent transcends science and is not so much about what science is about. And I mentioned that I have no problem whatsoever with astrology or I have slightly more of a problem with numerology. The problem with astrology, if somebody wants to look at it for fun, by all means, you know, I don't see any problem with that at all. It's entertainment. And one of the things that I say in the book is soccer is entertainment for a lot of people. Soccer riots have killed hundreds or perhaps thousands of people. I'm betting on thousands, considering that they happen frequently. I've never heard of astrology riots or numerology riots. So these are, you know,
good point.
But there is an indirect harm from things like this. And the indirect harm is that if you believe in something that counteracts known knowledge and you exercise your belief to exert control over someone else's life. For instance, I'm very much opposed to faith healing when it interferes with Western medicine. If a faith healer tells you he's going to put his hands on your child and cure your child's illness, and somebody says your child needs a blood transfusion desperately, and the faith healer says, no, let me handle this. If you trust the faith healer to do this, I have a lot of problems with this because I think you're doing something that is morally wrong. On the other hand, if you want to, you know, if you're 21 years old and you want to follow the dictates of the faith healer rather than the dictates of the doctor, that's perfectly fine with me. And my objection to numerology is that numbers, as you mentioned, they do have a connection to the universe because they're quantitative, and what we do is our objective universe is best understood from our standpoint if we measure stuff. Most of our great theories involve measuring things and predicting things like electromagnetism or radioactivity or gravity or things like that. And there are probably hundreds of millions of people on this planet who are fascinated by numbers as manifested through numerology. I'm guessing hundreds of millions because I think when you go into less westernized civilizations, you find it appealing to more people. And if you were to take those people who are fascinated by numbers and instead of having them look at numerology, if you have them actually study mathematics and science and engineering, you could get a cure for cancer out of these people or something. You know, you give me 100 million people with fascination for numbers and let them start studying math, science, and engineering, and it's going to make a significant difference to the planet as a whole, and maybe you and me. Maybe they'll discover something really worthwhile for us, whereas I can absolutely guarantee you they aren't doing anyone any good by studying numerology.
That's a fair point. And speaking of potential discoveries, something else I wanted to ask you about before, you know, we reached the end of the show was, what do you think about the study of dark energy and dark matter? Do you think that those things will help us uncover a little mystery about the universe?
They already are a mystery about the universe.
Right. Well, do you think they'll help us uncover like some kind of mechanism that's beyond us right now?
What dark matter consists of and what dark energy is are mysteries that are at the moment beyond us. We know they exist. We're absolutely certain dark matter exists. I think that with the awarding of the 1911 Nobel Physics Prize, I'm sorry, the 2011 Nobel Physics Prize for basically the discovery of dark energy, we're pretty much certain that there is such a thing as dark energy. And here was one of the points that I made in the book. We know that 95% of the universe is made up of dark matter and dark energy, and we have not the foggiest idea what they are. We have theories that predict what they might possibly be. None of them have been confirmed at the moment. So that's another reason that I'm with Einstein. Here, 95% of the universe is stuff that we can't explain. And yet we're going to rule out telepathy? I'm not in favor of that. Now, if you were to say to me, do you think that dark matter and dark energy will explain telepathy or precognition? I'd have to say no, but I'd have to say I think that the betting would be against that. But on the other hand, I certainly think that if telepathy becomes a confirmed phenomena, phenomenon. There is a possibility that dark matter or dark energy may possibly have something to do with it, but this much I do know at the moment. When we discover what they are, we'll know a lot more about the universe. We'll hopefully be able to take this knowledge and do something that can in some way benefit our species.
That's fair. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, because it really threw my college dropout stoner mind for a loop. It's something that you put in the book. Towards the end, there's a section on normal numbers, and you say, if you're a numerologist, what could be more wonderful than knowing the complete history of the universe is told in the digits of every single normal number, past and future? Of course, we'll never be able to interpret it. Can you elaborate on that? That blew my mind.
Sure. And as a matter of fact, it won't blow your mind after I explain it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. If you take a look at what is called ASCII, which is the American Society of Computation, and then some, what they do is they have a way of ascribing letters and characters to numbers. For instance, the one that I remember, because I used to be a computer programmer long ago, is that capital A is 65, capital B is 66, capital C is 67, etc. And all the basic characters in the alphabet, and also in the set of mathematical symbols and punctuation marks and spaces and stuff like that, there are 256 of them. And for instance, if you were to take, this is just an example, suppose that you were to look at pi, which everybody knows, it starts out as 3.14159. Well, what you could do is you could look at every two-digit combination, because the letters A, B, C, D, E, etc. go from like 64 to about 90 or something like that. And you could translate them by means of these letters. And because, for instance, I'm not sure how pi would start out when translated, but because all the sequences of any possible length of 1,000 letters or 100,000 letters or 10 billion letters will occur in pi over and over again. Sooner or later, your story and the history of the universe will be told, and it'll be told infinitely many times. And it's just a version of, did you ever hear about the monkeys and the typewriters?
I was just going to bring that up. That was going to be my answer back. Yeah.
It's exactly the same thing. If you have, you know, if you, probably very few of the people among your listeners know what a typewriter was. It's an antecedent of keyboard. It's mechanical rather than electronic. But there used to be, you know, they used to explain this in the following ways. If you let six monkeys loose a typewriter, sooner or later they're going to type the Declaration of Independence. Most of what they type is going to be garbage, of course. But sooner or later, because you've got an infinite amount of time, you'll hit the Declaration of Independence. They'll also do Einstein's theory of relativity, and in addition to which, they'll do all the profound theories that we will never, as human beings, know, because they've got an infinite amount of time to do it. And it is exactly the same phenomenon. What you have is you have an infinite amount of things of finite length, because if you start looking at what the monkeys type out, at any given stage, they've typed out a whole bunch of stuff, and sooner or later, after examining 100 billion pages of garbage, you see when in the course of human events it becomes necessary, or however the Declaration of Independence starts out, and then you look another 100 billion pages, and there it is again. Then you look another 5 trillion pages, and there it is about you, Greg. it's telling what you did on October 5th last year, and the same thing. You know, it's the same general principle.
It's kind of like it's foolish to say something's impossible in an infinite universe.
Well, what will happen is everything happens over and over and over again in an infinite universe, and that, to an essence, is the idea of parallel universes. If you look at, you know, the idea of parallel universes, in which I strongly believe, in which a lot of other scientists believe, if you take a look at, there's a wonderful article by a guy named Max Tegmark, and he says that the most the following idea is absolutely consistent with what we know at the moment. If you were to start reading this article, at this moment, you continue reading in another universe, somebody else exactly like you, living in exactly your house, living, wearing exactly the clothes that you're wearing at that moment, puts the article down and goes for a cup of coffee. And that's, you know, that's basically the same idea. Because our universe only has a finite amount of space, and we've only got a finite number of different types of atoms to play with in order to fill that space. If you've got, you know, it's the monkeys and the typewriters all over again.
Right. Do you think there's anything to the idea? It is kind of a New Age idea. They talk about intention and manifesting your reality, and sometimes they try to make it scientific by tying it into the idea of parallel universes. Do you feel like we'll ever get to a point where we could harness the idea of the infinite number of universes to walk the path of our most ideal life? Like, do you feel like it's totally different people, or can we jump into different timelines based on choice or what we want to happen?
Well, there are a couple of different explanations of that at the moment. I don't know that these are the only explanations, but one of them is the idea that this other parallel universe is so far from you that unless if you figure out a way to supersede the limitations of the speed of light traveling, which might be possible by some sort of extra-dimensional interconnection, which is mathematically allowable and which they're looking at, then that's one way to do it. But if you look at it from the probabilistic standpoint of quantum mechanics, that there's something called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which says that when something happens with possibilities, both possibilities happen, but they happen in different separate universes that will never meet. For instance, if afterwards you're going out for a hot dog, and you have a choice between putting mustard on it and pickle relish, and in one set of universes you put mustard on it, and another set of universes you put pickle relish on it, but these two sets of universes never intersect, and there's no way to go from one to the other.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, Jim, it's been a fascinating conversation. I could just bounce off random ideas off of you all day and just have you tell me how ridiculous or plausible it possibly could be. A lot of fun. But Kyle, was there anything you wanted to throw in before we wrap this up with Jim?
No, I just think it was a great interview. I really like talking to Jim about mathematics. And I think, you know, in general, when we think about mathematics, we have this very, you know, linear. We have these childhood memories of being in a classroom and memorizing basic equations. But when you're talking about something like Kurt Gödel, what you're really talking about is a form of like a formal logic, and it really blurs the line between philosophy and mathematics. Can be, you know, not so limited like we currently think of it. There's a lot of applications for it that we've yet to uncover.
Kyle, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, what most people think of as mathematics is really arithmetic. It's balancing your checkbook. What many people think mathematics is capable of is it's some sort of omniscient, godlike discipline, and it's not that either. But it's somewhere in between. And at its best, it does exactly the type of thing that you talk about. It blurs the line between logic, philosophy, etc., and it has something constructive to say about it. And also, what I like about mathematics, hey, is it's great for designing cars and things like that. You know, things that make my life better. I'm very much into, even though I was not an applied mathematician, I love the fact that what mathematics does is it explains things how things are, and when used in the proper framework, allows us to make a better life for ourselves. And that's its beauty and its glory, as far as I'm concerned.
Well said.
Yeah, that wasn't half bad.
yeah, good thing to go out on. Did you have a website or anything else you're working on that you'd like to clue people in on?
No, if people would like to get in touch with me personally, I teach mathematics at California State University, Long Beach, and I'm in the mathematics department. They'll find an email address for me. They can get in touch with me, and I'm a public, I'm an employee of the state of California, and if somebody writes and asks me a question, I'll answer it to the best of my abilities. And I'm always willing to discuss these things. If you want to get back to me at some stage and do another interview, I'm fine with that. But my there's a limit to what, you know, I try and limit what I say to what I know or what I think other people know. And if something is an opinion of mine, I try and clearly state that it's an opinion. And, for instance, on another show, somebody asked me, does science have anything to say about spirits? And at the moment, nada. It's because you can't even really define it. If you look at what the idea of a spirit is, you can't come up with a definition that everybody agrees on. And all scientists agree on what, say, for instance, mercury is, either the planet or the element. And all mathematicians agree on what a right triangle is. So we can get somewhere. But unless you can come up with a really good description of spirit and show me how to do something involving tests or something that I can measure or something that I can describe about it that will be the same for objective observers, can't do anything with it. Doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Right.
Beauty exists. But I can't, you know.
Right. Hard to define.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't really prove something is beautiful. You couldn't really prove somebody is happy. You know, internally, you don't know what's going on.
Sure, and as a matter of fact, there's Justice John Paul Stevens, I think that was his name, once said when confronted with pornography, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it."
Yeah, that's a great quote. Thanks again for being here. I guess we'll just keep waiting for the big breakthrough, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Okay, take care.
All right, take care, Jim.
Thanks.
Well, that was pretty fun.
Yeah, it was cool.
He said a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, I just think he's cool for being so – he's had such a long career in mathematics, and then to not dismiss paranormal phenomena, that's kind of a rarity.
Yeah, that is. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think he's totally deterministic, mechanistic, like so many scientists that I take issue with. But he's a lot more open-minded in other regards.
I mean, what did you think was the most interesting? Or was there anything you didn't get to comment on that you thought was worth commenting on?
It's hard to say. Like, he comes out pretty hard on numerology, but I think it's because he doesn't really understand it. And, you know, he's talking about this ACII program mapping out pi and how it eventually spells the story of everything that exists. And that's a really cool concept. But what he leaves out is that there are only the numerals 0 through 9. No other numerals exist. And we don't know if we invented the numerals or if we were given the numerals. I don't know that there's a real history of that account, because they are so distinct from one another. And as he says, you know, math is the language of everything. Well, if everything can be reduced to these specific 10 symbols and they are all independent of each other, then they all have very occult meanings and relate to a whole bunch of stuff that I think he's kind of leaving out.
Well, that's what I was getting at with the example of the number 8. Because that stuff is super fascinating to me. Whether it means anything or not, you know, is yet to be determined. But the idea that a number that people once viewed as a lucky number or a number that was really important to them, the atomic number of oxygen, which is clearly very important, it kind of matches up, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, there's really easy ones to grasp, like the number 2 has to do clearly with duality. You know, there's up and down, there's good and evil, there's light and dark. The number 4 has to do more with like the seasons, and it is traditionally in all sorts of ancient cultures, from the Mayans to, you know, all over the globe. These people who never talked to each other understood that the quaternity of a circle means you make 2 intersecting lines inside of a circle, and you have 4 equal sections, each with a right triangle in it, and that represents the seasons, the elements, the directions, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, so each number is a division of a subset of reality, and that's why they each have distinct meaning from each other.
Well, I'm glad that you were on this show particularly just because, like I said, you always were more left brain in school than I was. And, you know, now I think you've gone the other way and surpassed me by far. I haven't really gone anywhere. I mean, what would you say was the catalyst for you breaking the rigid structure of the left brain, other than, I would say, mushrooms would be your answer, but there's probably more to it.
Yeah, definitely mushrooms would be the initial catalyst, I would say. And it's been since then, you know, just a path of revealing. For me personally, you know, I feel like we were brought up in this culture. Like, we were taught this specific mindset that's very scientific and very dismissive of the occult or spiritual, or dismissive, you know, as Jim was, about whether lightning striking has to do with the gods or not. He seems pretty defiant to say, well, that's ridiculous. People in the past were just crazy to believe that. But that has to do with the context of what he was raised in. And I read a really good quote. I think this has a lot to do with my own awakening, is that you go through a process of unlearning what we've all inherited, and then you rediscover what is real and true for yourself. And so the imagery of this is you don't leave any rock unturned. So you go back through your whole life and look at what has happened, and you flip over the rocks and say, you know, do I really think that's true? I was told this. Is it really true that drinking 7-Up and having chicken noodle soup is going to cure the flu? I was told this was true.
Yeah. Well,
Does it still hold?
I actually, not long ago, I had gotten sick, and I've been trying to not drink soda, and I wanted a Sprite. I'm like, you know, I know that a Sprite is just fucking sugar and high fructose corn syrup and water, and I don't know what it is, but it makes me feel better. And to me, I guess that's just the power of the placebo effect. It's just, you know, it's just a way to take the idea of feeling better and manifest it into some physical thing that I can ingest. It's kind of like, I think it's the same idea with crystals. You know, when people are like, oh, I got this crystal because it's high, it gets me high energy. And it's like, well, you just want high energy. And it's kind of a placebo effect by taking this tool and putting it in your pocket and then feeling, oh, well, now that I have this, I have high energy. And I really think it's all just the power of the mind.
I think the placebo effect is definitely has something to do with it, because I think the way this actually works is you set up a symbol and you say, you know, if I hold this specific crystal, it's going to give me intuition. Or if I drink Sprite, it's going to help me cure my illness. And if you believe it, if you add your own subjective truth to it, and this is what science can't really measure, is subjective experience. But if you put belief into this symbol, then when you drink Sprite, it might have the placebo effect of actually working. Same about numerology too. If you are attributing a lot of meaning to the number 4, the number 8, and then you see that, it's going to trigger subjectively, you know, not something that can be measured, but it's going to trigger subjectively meaning within you. Maybe it's going to remind you of certain things, you know, that kind of stuff. You can get meaning. If you put meaning into it, you can get meaning back out of it.
It is a kind of a chicken and the egg thing. Like, is there meaning in the numbers that you're recognizing, or are you putting that meaning in the numbers? And if it's the latter, I mean, I don't know. To some extent, it just seems like silliness.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and definitely to the scientist, it seems like silliness. Because to someone who doesn't feel it, to someone who doesn't actually do it to them, they're going to say, well, this is an objective. You know, it's ridiculous. You think about numbers and something's, you're going to feel something. But to the person who feels something when they see a number, it can't really be explained. You know,
it's just as real as anything.
To explain the color green to somebody who's colorblind or something like that, they just don't. There is a blockage there. They're not going to understand it. And it has to do with what you're open to accepting is the big thing with, I guess, my whole path into more of a right-brained existence, trying to get in touch with my creativity, is to just try to have an open mind and let go of, you know, people are so goddamn sure of everything in this yeah. world. You know, when people say it's cold, they're fucking sure that it is, in fact, cold, whatever that means, and that it is not possibly not cold.
Right. And there's no way somebody's comfortable.
Yeah, there's no way. And this is not, you know, it's not just me. You're not saying I'm cold. You're saying it, this goddamn thing all around us. This fucking thing is cold. I'm so sure of it. So I am a big, you know, I'm not so sure of a lot of things.
Right. When you, it's like, tell that to a penguin or a polar bear that it's cold. You know, it's just your subjective experience. And everybody's so confident to project that out and take it as, you know, written in stone.
Yeah, well, I was excited, too, about this interview, just to kind of change it up just a minute, because he is mentioning Kurt Gödel. That I accidentally took this course when I was finishing up my philosophy major that was meant for philosophy graduate students. And it was like, you know, I don't know, a 7,000 level course, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah.
And it was called Formal Logic, and we learned about Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And at the time, I was like, what the hell am I learning? I have no idea. Like, it was overwhelming in a lot of ways when you really break down. When you're reading the texts, it almost makes no sense at all. But when you kind of explain it colloquially, you understand what he was getting at. But yeah, it was exciting that this guy's talking about Gödel's incompleteness theorem and how that validates what the mystics had been saying all along, is that there is unknowability. There is something you can't even know that's present. And when I say people are so goddamn sure of everything, they have forgotten mystery. They have forgotten having wonder like a child has. Like, they don't know what's going to happen or what reality even is. They're just like, whoa, this is kind of a lucid dream experience. I'm just going to interact with whatever comes my way. And I think it has so much to do with wonder, or with, you know, accepting that there is mystery and unknowable things. And you got to be open to that shit.
Hear, hear. Great conversation. I'm really glad you could be here. This is going to be fun, this co-hosting thing. We also have Jake Bender and Adam Gorightly. But Kyle will be here on the third week of every month. And you're going to be writing that column, Conversations with the Other. Very cool. You know, everybody, you know, thanks for listening. Please review the show, share the show, favorite the show. Donate if you can. You know, if every THC listener donated $1 a year, I'd be able to surpass what I make at my store manager job in a year. I mean, that's kind of crazy. Not that you're going to get that to happen. It would be pretty insane. But, I mean, that's crowdsourcing, yeah. Though.
And if half of you donated $2, we'd get there even faster.
Right. anything else you want to add?
No, that's it, man.
Cool.
Thank you for the opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
Of course, man. I'll talk to you in a month. I declare this meeting of the Midnight Society closed.
3-0, it's the magic number. Yeah, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in that ancient mystic trinity, you'll get 3. It's the magic number. In the past, in the present, in the future, faith and hope and charity, in the heart and the brain and the body, will give you 3. It's a magic number. It takes 3 legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand, and it takes 3 wheels to make a vehicle called the tricycle,
yeah.
And every triangle has 3 corners, every triangle has 3 sides. No more, no less, you won't have to guess. Now it's 3.
predict the pattern once more.
3, 6, 9.